You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. Welcome to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, the third of the Velo News Podcast. I'm with the dream team of Matt Bowden.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And Andy Hood.
Good evening, fellas. Thanks for having us back.
Also Lionel Burney. Evening, Richard. And he's been begging to be part of this podcast for 2 weeks now, Daniel Freeb.
Hi, chaps. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, Daniel. Now, let's start with Matt telling the listeners where we are. Where are we, Matt?
We're in the lovely medieval city of Carcassonne, France.
Anything more than that?
I can't help but feel put on the spot here, seeing as how I just asked the history, Richard Moore, and your response was, it's very, very old.
It's very old and very beautiful, isn't it? It's very beautiful. We're in a bar, on a sort of terrace of a bar, right out in the heart of the old town. Richard Veronque was walking past a minute ago. Well, actually, he stopped in the bar and was photographed by lots of people. A real popular attraction here in Carcassonne. In this beautiful medieval city, Richard Veronque is the main attraction. Now, Lionel, you've got a question for our American friends here to kick off tonight's podcast.
I have indeed. As we record this, the second rest day is finished. The race resumes with the Pyrenees. TJ Van Garderen, very highly placed overall, fifth place. How excited are you guys about having potentially the first American on the podium since Greg LeMond?
I think TJ is garnering a lot of excitement back in the States.
I didn't get the joke. Anyway, go on, Andy.
No, I think that it is it's the new generation of Americans coming up, and you know, TJ is every year taking new steps and bigger steps to get to this point, and he's the team captain. You know, Cadel Evans raced the Giro, and he's had a pretty bumpy ride, and he's come through the other end in good position. Four crashes, he's been on antibiotics, he's really poised for the podium, and personally, I think he's going to finish second on this tour.
What a professional answer that was, Matt.
You know, I think what's good for the goose is certainly good for the gander. If he does a good ride, I mean, the Americans, they love to read about it. Personally, you know, we cover whatever the story is, you know, whoever that may be. And so for TJ, it's, you know, is there a bit of nationalistic tendency? Sure. I mean, I think it would be remiss to pretend that there wouldn't be. But, you know, somebody asked me who my favorite rider was a couple weeks ago, and I just stood there sort of for a minute, and I didn't actually have an answer, because to me I sort of look at the whole sport and I don't necessarily have favorites, and that's probably a really good thing.
Probably a good time to pause here. The bidons of beer are being delivered to our table. Much needed refreshment for our mini peloton here.
They're a bit delayed because there was such a huge fuss over Richard Veronque in the bar, but they're here now. What was that, Daniel? That's a Richard Veronque impersonation there for those not familiar. It is amazing, though, isn't it, lads, that no American has finished on the podium in 34 years.
I see what you're trying to do here.
I know. No, twenty-four. Sorry.
I know the road you're trying to go down. It's like I think, you know. While we can agree
cheers.
That may
cheers.
While we
can. More important than that.
Well, that may be a tech. I had to take a sip of beer before I gave this answer. That's an absolute technicality, right? I mean, because we're trying to pretend that a certain somebody named Lance Armstrong didn't win seven tours in a row. Now, I'm not going to go say he won those tours outright. That's not really what I can do, but what I can say is, I mean, what everyone always says, you want him on the road, and, you know, I think that if people were asked to recall who won those tours, they would still say Lance Armstrong, so.
Now, we got in trouble last week for not mentioning the other American riders in the race. There are more than just, as it was last week, TJ Van Garderen and Andrew Talansky. Talansky, of course, no longer in the race. But we were at the BMC press conference today, and we spoke to TJ Van Garderen, also spoke to Peter Stettina, one of his main allies in the mountains, and play here an interview. I was there with Andy Hood. Here is Peter Stettina.
It's good. It's a good experience. It's tough, though. Until the first rest day, the first 10 days were... It was hard to have fun, actually. It was just so stressful, and crashes, and the weather, and the rain, and the wind, and even the fans in Britain, like, they actually were deciding the race more than the racers, and I was really glad to get through that, and I just tried to stay as safe as possible. I was at the back trying to just not get caught up in a lot of the crashes and the mayhem. And sometimes that's good because you stay safe, but sometimes it's bad because you have to ride a bit harder back there out of the corners and stuff. And knock on wood, I've kept all my skin on so far, and I got over a cold in that first week as well, and then and then we got to the Alps and things started to go more my way, and I was able to help TJ in the mountains and looking to do that again in the Pyrenees.
Is there more responsibility for you now that Atapuma's out of the race?
Yeah. Darwin was a key player in the mountains. Along me and Darwin were supposed to be the guys with TJ till the finale. And now that Darwin's out, it's a bit more responsibility on my shoulders. I got to be a lot more consistent for sure. But we also have Peter Villetson and Mel Moynard, and they've all stepped up as well. And even Mickey Schaar, you see, he's climbing in the front group the other day.
What's the ambiance at the dinner table now? I mean, TJ is riding very well positioned into the Pyrenees.
It's really good. It's really the same as when the race started. You know, there's still, when the race starts, there's a lot of hope, there's a lot of motivation, and nothing bad has happened to lose that. So we're keeping it light. We're having fun at the dinner table and, you know, just general smack talk and nothing really bike racing related. And, we're all ready for the task at hand, and we can actually see it becoming a possibility.
Mm-hmm. So. Is that how you kind of decompress from the pressure of the tour a little bit, just the stresses that come with this race? Talk about other things at the dinner.
Yeah. We talk about funny or odd or crazy things that happen during the day and just normal talk, normal life. And then I try to switch off the cell phone a little earlier in the night and just watch a movie or read a book or something, just get unconnected. So.
And going into the Pyrenees, the team plan obviously is to stay close to the French climbers and keep those podium hopes alive, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, everyone's looking at TJ to pull out a good final time trial, but I mean, he's climbing with those guys anyway. I mean, if there's even the chance to take time, I'm sure we'll do it. And like yesterday, you saw almost, you never know with this wind, and maybe stage 19, something happens. The weather's so, it's swirling and it's ever changing out here. So that's a big factor right now, but yeah. And, for me, I want to try to keep with TJ and, help them keep those French climbers in check and Valverde until stage 20 for him.
What's been the biggest surprise on those big climbs in the Alps so far, just in terms of compared to other races you've done?
The climbs aren't any. I mean, it's the field's a lot deeper. Everyone's on their best form. So in some races, when there'll only be 10 guys left, now there's 40 guys left over the top of a pass, even though you're all going max. It's it really is hundredths of a percentage between guys actually getting dropped and not getting dropped. So you really just have to do everything right before you even hit the climb. Make sure you're fueling right all day. You just can't mess up even before the run into the climb.
That's just the kind of a demonstration of how high the level is at the tour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this is the big show, and everyone has brought their A game. So that's why it's so fast.
Is there a sense of anticipation that the podium's within reach?
Yeah. I think it's a reality, and I think everyone's kind of seeing that. And we kind of, you know, we batted the idea around even at before the tour started up in Val Gardena. You know, we're like, yeah, podium, that's doable. You know, we can get that. And now it seems it's definitely a possibility. But every day something's changing here, so we're really. Yeah, we're looking, I think, at a podium, but we're really still doing the day-by-day program, because that's all you can do out here now. Is even yesterday, someone could have lost the tour just because of, you know, a stupid wind or a crash or something like that. So,
you're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So we heard there from Peter Stethen. Now, he was very laid back, relaxed, seems to be coping quite well with his first tour after, I think, a difficult first week or so. It seems to have settled down into a a rhythm now that's better for guys like that. And he's, I think, looking forward to the Pyrenees, although he admitted that he's never actually climbed these mountains. What were your impressions, Andy, of him and also TJ Van Garderen? I mean, you spoke to him a little bit today. What did you make of his sort of state of mind?
I think the team is pretty confident, really. Like TJ's been saying, you know, as Aysen Nohal was that final time trial, he thinks they can get back at least a minute on the little French climbers. So I think they're very confident in terms of, you know, if they can keep close to Bardet, Pinot, maybe stay ahead of Perrault, they have a pretty good shot at finishing third and perhaps even getting ahead of Valverde. But as we all know, that final time trial is not always as decisive as, say, in the first week when everyone's fresh and the specialists have their tanks full. And plus, it's quite a hilly course. I mean, I haven't actually seen the course, but it's not just a straight power course.
Stand up for the French climbers, Daniel.
No, I think Hoodie's dead right. I think Van Garderen will probably take time on particularly Bardet. I expect Pinot to be a bit stronger, obviously, depending on what happens between now and then, how many bullets they all use up. I see Van Garderen really threatening them and their position on GC at the moment. And perhaps second, that's quite a bold statement, Hoodie, Van Garderen to finish second. But I think he's certainly got a chance of that. And Valverde talked today in his press conference about feeling better than he had at the start of the race and really kind of growing into this tour. I still think that he will have something to say in the Pyrenees and his team as well. I mean, Unzué, the Movistar manager, talked about that today, about how the team, pretty much everyone on that team feels good at the moment. They haven't really got any major physical problems, which is unusual at the moment in the tour. Most of the teams are nursing illnesses or injuries, but Movistar are pretty much at full strength.
Well, I tipped TJ Van Garderen to finish third overall in last year's tour in our preview podcast nearly 13 months ago now, so not bad to be only a year out.
Valverde, though, I mean, he was tailed off on the climb to Rizul on Sunday in the Alps. He seemed to crack on that climb. Is he going to come good in the Pyrenees? Because it seemed there that he was sort of at his limit, and when the pressure was really on, those French climbers did take a little bit of time out of him.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Daniel said. I mean, they've been planning to hit their peak at the Pyrenees all season. I mean, Valverde didn't race the Dauphiné or Tour de Suisse with the idea of kind of coming in, riding into form into this tour, you know, if that's possible these days, and then carrying that strength into the Vuelta and the Worlds, where he wants to try to win another medal. So I think that, I mean, it will be a lot for, say, Van Garderen to try to get ahead of Valverde. He's also the Spanish national time trial champion, so he's not a total slack against the clock. What do you think, Matt?
I think metronomic TJ, you know, the Pyrenees would be much tougher than the Alps, but I think that, like we said, that final time trial certainly suits him. I mean, I think he'll do a really good performance there. Will it be good enough to ride in a second overall? You know, I'm definitely not sure. I wouldn't expect to see fireworks from TJ and BMC in the Pyrenees, certainly not. I think it's more of racing to limit losses to guys like the French guys.
Mike, you described him then as metronomic, but there have been a lot of ups and downs in his career. I mean, he turned pro, when was it, 2011 with HTC, or 2010. And, you know, there have been these flashes of real promise and that have suggested that he was going to be a future Grand Tour winner, and then he's had a whole seasons almost where you've sort of had to revise that assessment. What do you put that down to, that he has been slightly inconsistent until now?
Well, when I said metronomic, I meant sort of in the terms of his physiological makeup. I mean, he's much, much better suited to put out a high threshold and not respond to spikes. But so that was in an acute sense. But in a broader sense of what you were talking about, I mean, I guess it's hard to know exactly. I mean, you look at the 2012 tour, he had a good, solid tour. He rode to fifth, he won the white jersey, and he was, you know, he never had a terrible day. And then you look at last year, he had that absolutely terrible day in the Pyrenees, and it was over from the start. So I don't know what I would attribute that to. I mean, it'd be easy to say youth, you know? I mean, but beyond that, I mean, I'm just not sure. I mean, I guess he's up and down, but I think
I think in the third week here he'll be pretty good.
Sorry, Richard, I was just going to say on the Col d'Izoard, on the descent of the Col d'Izoard, he got distance a little bit, and he relied on his teammates to get him back into position. But and then he put a comment on Twitter saying, "I won't make that mistake again." It did seem that he's obviously got good legs because of the work that he did on the front on the final climb up to Risoul, but it just a moment's kind of inattention almost caught him out, and it was quite sort of ironic really that skinny little AG2R riders were putting him in difficulty.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you have to be at the absolute pinnacle of attention, especially coming over a climb like that with the senders as good as Nibali on the front. It can just fly off the front at any minute, and if he wasn't paying attention, then you certainly can get caught out. I mean, fortunately he has a strong team, not in a great climbing sense, but they can put out good power for good periods of time, and they could, I think that they're a bit underrated in this tour, and I guess we'll see in the next 2-3 days what they're really made of.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the personality behind the man behind the mask, the Van Garderen mask? Because he's certainly not got a profile anything like, say, Taylor Finney or even Andrew Talansky. And yet he's a very solid rider. I think solid is the word, isn't it? He's a sort of, is he somebody that the American cycling fans, is he somebody they can and will get excited by? I interviewed him in 2010 at the Vuelta, which he was riding his first Grand Tour, and I found him quite an engaging guy. He had this lovely story about having gone to meet Greg LeMond as a kid with the Greg LeMond complete book of cycling or something, and getting him to sign it. He's got heart, he's clearly quite passionate about his sport, but he does seem to sort of fly below the radar a little bit in terms of profile and publicity.
I think he struggled a little bit with having that attention and that media attention on him. Even he said being with this tour last year, he actually turned off his Twitter account because he didn't like some of that negative feedback he was getting from some of just the Twitterati. But he's one of these freaks of the bike. I mean, he won like 13 or 11 junior national championships. He's been good on a bike since he's 12 years old. His dad was a big cyclist from Colorado. But I think he's growing into that role. I mean, he's used to being, like he said, even today, he goes, yeah, I've been a team captain for the last couple of years anyway. This is my first time really leading the tour. He's comfortable in that role. I think he'll grow more into being more perhaps of a public figure. I think that doesn't come to him naturally, like a guy like Taylor Finney, who is just like the class clown, or he's the rock star. Whereas TJ is kind of used to letting his legs do the talking and doesn't really like that kind of media focus or that public attention on him. In fact, he even said today, because what the media says and writes about me doesn't really affect anything in the race.
It clearly affects him though. I mean, Peter Stettina also. Andy, do you feel sort of undermined by that claim? You like to think that everything that you write is being read by TJ and the others. I'm sure it is. I'm sure.
They read our stuff. I mean, who knows? I mean, who knows if TJ is reading anything? Because if I was racing in the race, I wouldn't read anything, actually, to tell the truth. But I know all their sport directors certainly do, and they're always reminding us of what we get right or wrong in our stories just about every day. It's always right, though.
Some sports directors even listen to podcasts.
Do they really?
Pretty offensive.
It's so hard. So I've heard.
Who?
Team principals.
It's better. It's easier than reading, right?
It is easier than reading, and this talking bit is easier than writing as well, isn't it? If you're going to read,
I mean,
two writers at the Tour de France, so Matt Bowden, Andy Hood, Velo News, the dream team, as I said, the dream team. We're just chatting our way through this tour. It's great fun.
I think to what you asked about TJ, do people engage with him like they might engage with another rider? I mean, and maybe this answers the question, but like my short answer is I don't know. I mean, I had a great chat with him. I remember in Oman this year, the Tour of Oman, and I asked him a bunch of questions, and he gave a bunch of great, thoughtful, what I thought were, because we're always judging, right? But what I thought were solid and genuine answers, and so I had seen in him there sort of a relaxation that doesn't exist at this race, and certainly you can't fault a guy for that. But I remember last year on the top of Alpe d'Huez, and everybody probably remembers he was in the breakaway that day, and it was the double Alpe d'Huez stage, and he descended the Col de Sirene, and he had a mechanical, and then he was on the second climb of Alpe d'Huez, and it looked like he was going to win the stage, and then he suffered a pretty bad crack, and he didn't win the stage. He got to the top, and he was really emotional, and understandably so. But I think a guy like TJ, just because he's not saying it doesn't mean he's not feeling it.
Feeling it.
And that's, you know, that is a ridiculous amount of conjecture on my part.
That was an incredible stage. It was, yeah, Christoph Riblon, of course. I wonder if he gets flashbacks when he sees the brown shorts of AG2R.
Maybe you should ask him tomorrow. I'm not going to ask him.
Now he's surrounded by the brown shorts of AG2. I wonder if he gets flashbacks to that awful moment when Riblon came past him. Because, he was heading for the stage when, and Riblon just clawed him back and clawed him back. And you said he was emotional at the summit, was he? I didn't actually see him at the summit.
He was angry. He was angry, you know. And I think he suffers from what would, I guess, could only be construed as sort of this great American expectation, right? Because Americans don't necessarily care about anybody other than winners. I say that in a general sense, but what brought Americans to bike racing, most Americans, and, you know, some people might think it's ridiculous, but it's flat not, was Lance Armstrong. I mean, so that's what they care about. That's what they expect to see. And so, you know.
I thought it was Andy Hood that brought most Americans to bike racing. I mean, Hoodie's been doing this for, what, 20 years now?
37 years.
Pioneer. At our best, we can hope to be but a conduit, right? And Hoodie, you're a hell of a conduit.
Well, I think you have to say, you know, the generation before that, before your time, you know, Le Mans was the first wave, Armstrong was the second, and what we're seeing now are these kind of third wave guys coming through with this new generation of Americans, which, you know, they're riding in a different time and place than those previous two generations did. And I think the fans that were turned on by the tour through Le Mans into Armstrong, you know, they love the tour. It's not just a specific, you know, rider or nation. So I think the riders today have that kind of base that those other guys didn't obviously have.
Yeah, my impressions of Van Garderen are very positive, that he's a hard-working, very humble, down-to-earth guy who does probably deserve the sport. He's not as brash, not as colourful, not as flamboyant as certain others, but he is a solid, hard-working guy who does deserve, I think, people's support. And it's worth adding as well that when I did that interview with him in 2010, doping was high on the agenda, and he spoke about that very, very openly and very eloquently and intelligently and very well.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
The third Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, Andy Hood, and Matt Bowden. And Matt has expressed a desire to talk about the cruelty of the sport. I suppose we had that last week with Andrew Talansky and his sad exit, really. He struggled on, finished stage wherever it was. I can't remember now where that was. Anybody remember where that was?
Oyonnax.
Anyway, that was, he's gone now. He's part of the tour history. A lot of expectations around him, but we'll have to wait for another year. And on Sunday, we had Jack Bauer suffering a terrible. I think you're keen to talk about this, Matt. You were quite affected by Jack Bauer, the Garmin Sharp rider, the New Zealander, who was away for 222 kilometres almost.
Matt has been really badly affected by this. I've seen him in the press room the last 24 hours.
Really?
I didn't go to the press room the last 24 hours. You've seen my ghost or somebody like me.
What were you saying about 24 hours?
Did we just talk about heartbreak for a minute, right? Right,
let's just
talk. because you think
once again this podcast is veering into territory that a cycling podcast really should tell us all about heartbreak.
Oh, because you see a guy who's out there in the wind and the rain with just one other compatriot for 220Ks, and you think that maybe it could stay, that maybe Icarus has not flown too close to the sun this time, Daniel, and that maybe we all have a reason to hope in things that shouldn't really happen. And yet, he's caught on the line, and the wolves of the peloton eat the deer of the breakaway yet again, and it just crushes us.
I love it when we're joined by the Americans on the podcast.
Yeah. It just crushes us, right? And I just, like, oh, man. You just, Daniel didn't want to talk about this, but I brought it up because I do. And you just think that, oh, you know, 20 years from now, no one's going to remember that Jack Bauer finished second like this.
I would argue they would almost remember it more than they would if he'd won the stage.
I believe you just said that you would not remember who almost won a stage. I believe you just said that.
I did not say that.
And the thing is, we need actors in the great play, right? Because they give us the winners. So if everybody just laid down and did the expected thing all day and was like, oh, we're not going to fight this out, I mean, then yeah, we would get these ridiculous foregone conclusions of bike races.
Jack Bauer is clearly a very strong rider. You know, they did incredibly well, him and Martin Elmiger, to hold off the rampaging bunch over the last 20 kilometres. It reminded him a bit of David Miller's stage win in 2012, where, again, Garmin Sharp had their wings clipped there. They lost their leaders then as well in the big crash on the way into Metz that year, when they lost rider Hesjedal, Tom Danielson. And they had a lot of freedom to do things that they wouldn't otherwise have had. And similarly, Jack Bauer, this is probably the first and only chance in his second tour to get into a breakaway like that. And it almost, you know, his success rate was almost 100%, because he's never been in a breakaway in the tour, and there he almost won the stage. I remember also last year with Jack Bauer that he had a terrible crash, landed on his face, and he appeared in Paris for the end of tour party. His face was a mess.
It was on the Glandon, right?
Called the Glandon. Yeah. And he I think he couldn't eat, could he? He could only drink.
He was drinking through a straw still in Paris, and he turned up there to basically drink champagne through a straw. And he was looking forward to the fact that that would get him drunk pretty quickly on the last night of the tour. I just want to agree with Matt and say something about these stories that we get now in the tour, and without wanting to criticise Lance Armstrong, because it's not his fault. But during those years that Lance Armstrong dominated the tour, the narrative of the tour became so totally about the yellow jersey and the race for the yellow jersey. And I remember the kind of almost sending it out on loan to somebody and then calling it back in when he wanted it. And these kind of the stage winners' stories became a little bit overlooked. Certainly my perception, being part of the English-speaking media, although not American. And I just think that it's great that the tour has got these kind of stories back now, and that Jack Bauer's, you know, near miss will become kind of mythologized in years to come.
I'd agree with that, Lionel. I wanted to ask our American friends a different question about Garmin Sharp. We've talked a lot about Plan Bs in this Tour de France, particularly in relation to Sky. Would you agree that going into the Tour with Talensky, with pretty much everything behind Talensky, and we're talking about Garmin Sharp here, was slightly risky, and that Garmin Sharp are paying for that now?
I mean, was it any riskier than their tour plan of the past couple of tours, which was just to bring up some stage hunters and sort of cause mayhem? I mean, I think it was the first year they really committed to a GC guy since when? I mean, Hood's going to have to speak to that exactly. But to me, it's like they backed a horse, didn't work out, and now they're sort of having to respond to that. But I don't think it's much different than Sky. I mean, they had a strict plan A, and then you're seeing that now. And I think that ultimately Sky will have a more disappointing Tour de France than Garmin Sharp.
Yeah, I think Garmin actually last couple. This is a different shift in their strategy. Because they did just build a whole team around Talensky. It's kind of like this is the first year of what they said with many trying to get Talensky onto the podium. Because in the past, they did kind of bring two or three darts to throw at the dartboard. This was Dan Martin or Ryder Hesjedal. You know, Wiggins was with those guys, Tom Danielson, Vandeveld. They all kind of popped into the top five. One every year just kind of popped out of nowhere. And next year was somebody else. So this is really the first time they actually did bring a team just built around one guy. So it was new for the team. And you're right, Daniel. I mean, it might have been a risk because now they don't have much left over. But
And Hoodie, exacerbated by the fact that they were largely inexperienced guys. I mean, Slagter's never won a stage in the Tour. You know, they picked Ben King, Alex Howes, who all potentially could have done a great job for Talensky. But there was no one. You know, you say that it was similar to last year, but last year they had multiple tour stage wins. Had, you know, I don't know if it was the Brisky Road last year, but you know, they had guys like Miller and
they brought a very young team, very inexperienced team. Yeah. And I think it's part of their program to build a team for the future. And also I think that perhaps the team's going in a different direction for the future, and they didn't want to bring those older guys to the tour.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, we're still here in the beautiful city of Carcassonne with its attractions and distractions, sitting out here in the street drinking some beers, and it's very, very pleasant indeed. We're going to go for Cassoulet in Carcassonne's number one Cassoulet restaurant quite soon. Before we do, somebody, I think it was Andy Hood, brought up the fact that we're quite well into this podcast now and haven't mentioned Vincenzo Nibali, the guy who's leading it. Andy, you've got some things to say about Vincenzo Nibali?
I just think it's an impressive the kind of tour that he's having. I'm absolutely flawless, really. I mean, Daniel, you probably know him a little bit better than I do because you speak the Italian with Vincenzo. But he seems like he's been breathing through a straw this entire tour. Hasn't been seriously challenged by anyone. You know, rampaged across the cobblestones and has just completely smashed everyone in the mountains. And absolutely leaving no doubt who deserves to win this Tour de France. And I think that's, you know, a story that's been kind of overlooked in the sense everyone's saying, well, you know, Contador's not here, Froome's not here, Port flamed out. But, I mean, Nibali has just been impeccable, really.
I mean, pretty much what he said.
Matt's more comfortable speaking about the Americans.
You make a strong case. I think we could say a lot here. We could say Nibali looks incredible. He's flying. He looks amazing on the climbs. I mean, and all those things are true. I think he looks a lot better than he is in relation to the sport's absolute best climbers right now. So I think what you're internalizing is seeing as a transcendent Nibali is really just a very, very, very good Nibali that would be. You know, was he dropping? Would he drop Contador? Would he drop Froome? I don't think so. But of course, we don't know. Of course, he was. I think he would win this Tour de France regardless. He wouldn't be. I don't think he would be riding alone at the front anyway. So clearly, the best man is going to win the Tour. But I don't think what we're seeing is an honest comparison to the best bike racers in the world.
We'll probably go back to, and I was talking about this with you today, Matt, because I think you're working a story on the cobbled stage for. Sorry, am I giving the game away there? But I think we'll go back to that stage, stage five. And, you know, even as we head into the Pyrenees, over half of his overall lead was built on that day. And, yeah, we have been deprived of this fascinating battle that no doubt would have taken place as Contador and Froome tried to nibble away at that 2.5 minutes that he claimed. And the way he is climbing, the way he's riding, you wonder if they would have... It would have been close. What do you think, Daniel?
I don't know. I think in the past we've been very scathing of these sort of estimates of power output and wattages and so forth. But
hang on, I didn't mention power output.
No,
wattages.
But I think that they do tell us a lot, and well, they can tell us a lot. And in this case, in this tour, the figures that I've seen suggest that Nibali, his performances have not been that extraordinary, and he probably would have struggled. What's going on there?
I think someone's storming the gates.
Yeah. I think he would have struggled against the Froome. My word.
Obviously, the French.
Who let the dogs out? Anyway, he would have struggled against the Froome that we saw last year. I've been getting a lot of. I don't want to exaggerate how sort of how active I am on Twitter or how active people are in replying to me, but I've been getting quite a few messages over the last few days about. You know, his performance is being unbelievable and defying, you know, any kind of logic. But I just don't see this. And, you know, for me, Nibali's performances have been completely in line with the rest of his career so far and the natural progression of someone who is now 29, and completely also in line with the competition he's facing. You know, like we made the point a couple of nights ago about Jean-Christophe Perrault was stuck with him all the way to Rizal. I just don't see anything extraordinary about it whatsoever.
No, I think, sorry, Richard, again, cutting over you there. Like, you know, but I think the thing is that the person who wins the Tour becomes the lightning rod for all of the questions and suspicion. But when you actually break down what Nibali has done, he managed to catch up to Rafał Majka and Leopold Koenig on the Stade de Chamrousse and drop them and leave them for 10 seconds. And those guys have been out there for, you know, a long time. And really, Nibali's strength has been how smart he's ridden. He is winning the Tour by taking, as Richard says, these Nibali-sized chunks of time when he knows he's strong. And he's doing it quite methodically, cleverly. He's not stretching himself. He knows that there's probably these three tough stages in the Pyrenees to come. I don't get the feeling that he's extended himself into the red at all.
It's also a reflection of the field that he's racing against. Yeah. He doesn't have to go further. I think he could go further. And as the Belgians say so well, if my uncle had tits, she'd be my aunt. You have to judge things based on what is here. Froome and Contador are out of the race. And it doesn't matter. We could just talk all day. It's like, yeah, maybe Nibali would get dropped by those guys, but I don't think Nibali's been pushed to his limit yet.
You know, I've had messages to the... Sorry, Matt was desperate to jump in there. I've had messages to the effect that it's impossible for Nibali to have progressed as much as he has since the Dauphiné. Well, you know, that was 6 weeks ago now. And, you know, realistically, if Nibali... Let's say Nibali was doping. He hasn't started doping in the last 6 weeks. He's probably... You know, when have you ever read a rider's memoir where he said, you know, I started doping sort of 6 weeks before a Tour de France that I really needed to win? It doesn't happen like that. If he's cheating, he's been cheating probably since the word go. So I just don't see that as a feasible hypothesis.
But as you've said in our other Telegraph cycling podcast, supported by Jaguar, Daniel, that his career trajectory has been consistent, steady, and, you know, I mean, I'm kind of loath to go down this road of... This sort of quite meaningless speculation, really. Also, as Andy says, in terms of the whole power output part, the wattages debate hasn't really happened this year. There hasn't seemed to be so much attention on that, which perhaps could be...
I think because the numbers are actually within the parameters of what people think is fairly normal.
Yeah, but I mean, I think Nibali's done what he's had to do, and as Andy says, I think if Contador and Froome had been in the race, we'd have probably seen better numbers from Nibali because he'd have had to push himself a bit harder. So I mean, I don't. We've had this discussion before, but I don't really. And I know Matt is. We've had a discussion with Matt as well that I don't buy this X figure equals suspicion.
I just don't see any red flags. I don't see any specific red flags either in his performances or anything he's said in press conferences. And also, you know, people talk about the association with Vinokourov and Martinelli, who was Pantani's director sportif. I mean, it's either naive or I think it's intellectually dishonest to suggest that director sportifs now are actively involved in teams' doping programs. We haven't seen that for years. You know, the last documented case of a director sportif having some influence in a doping program was probably Johan Bruneel with Lance Armstrong. So that is not how cycling works now. If someone is cheating, they are not... You know, they're not taking advice from their direct sportive. So Martinelli being there, Vinokourov being there, to me, it's kind of meaningless.
I think suspicion's lower at this tour, too, because we haven't had that visceral sort of moment, which was Froome absolutely annihilating Alberto Contador on the Ventoux last year, that sort of forced us all to stand there and say, is that exceptional? Is it surreal? What are we looking at? This year, I think it's been... You know, much more subdued.
But sorry to come back in there again. It's an argument I've made time and time again. The Nibali's performance on the cobbles was exceptional. Nobody equated that to doping. We watch this sport, we watch any elite sport to see exceptional performances. Guys at this level should be, the guys who win should be producing exceptional performance. That's the whole point, isn't it? And so I don't, again, looking back at Froome last year, I don't look at his performance on Ventoux, and that doesn't for me raise a red flag, to use Daniel's expression, purely on the basis of how it looked. I just don't buy that at all. But we've had this discussion time and time again, and we're going to carry on having it, aren't we?
I was speaking to Sebastian Weber, the Cannondale coach today, who's Peter Sagan's coach, who we'll hear from in the Telegraph podcast tomorrow. But he was talking about how it's almost strange that the focus has fallen on the general classification riders and the power output that they're capable of, and there's been no attention whatsoever on what the sprinters are putting out. You know, and if it could be that Marcel Kittel is putting out 2,500 watts, which is, you know, according to conventional wisdom, is an impossible figure, but no one is interested in that. No one is debating that. I don't think that is the case. But
it's harder to calculate, yeah, isn't it? That's the bottom line. I mean, the climbs are relatively easy, not that easy, but relatively easy to arrive at a figure. And so, you know, again, for the cobble stage, you know, what was Nibali putting out there? It was an amazingly impressive performance.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to put out, to ride like that, a little skinny climber guy, to ride like that on the cobbles, that's the outstanding performance of not just this tour, but the last two or three tours.
But it would to skill, you know, yeah, and you see that, again, absolutely. Also with the on the climbs is there's like an equation. It's power to weight. Whereas if you're a sprinter or a cobbled rider, you can see that there's an awful lot of skill and bike handling ability and all the rest of it involved. And I would argue that's the case for any discipline within cycling. Should we finish up there? Daniel's quite adamant about that. We're all getting hungry, I think. Well, we're gonna be back for one more Velo News cycling podcast before the end of the tour. We'll wrap things up with Matt and Andy again. But Matt, thank you very much again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you very much, and merci beaucoup.
Daniel.
It's been like a transatlantic odyssey. This has been a real insight into a different world for me.
Lionel.
Can we have some cassoulet now?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much for listening.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.